This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. Media Watch this weekend looks at two very different topics which have both generated closely contested complaints about their coverage in the media lately. We'll hear about the special sensitivity surrounding coverage of Middle East affairs, and we'll hear why two opposing sides both reckon the media don't do them justice, both overseas and here in New Zealand. But first, we look at the final outcome of TV presenter Paul Henry's put down of singing star Susan Boyle, fully 9 months after it first hit the headlines. But was it just bad taste or something worse?
He's filming bits and pieces, snippets from their life, and they're turning it into a reality programme. Of course, it will be sanitised because he's filming it. So there you have it. That is the women's magazines for this week, and it is 4 minutes away from 8 o'clock.
That was Pippa Wetzel, the co-presenter of TV1's breakfast show last Monday, ending the program's weekly look at some of the stories on offer in the latest women's magazines. And what followed that was a follow-up on the same part of the same program, which was broadcast 8 months ago.
Last year, during What's in the Mags, Breakfast screened comments about the singer Susan Boyle. The comments were made by a Breakfast presenter and concerned Miss Boyle's intellectual disability. TVNZ upheld viewers' complaints that the comments... broadcasting standard requiring good taste and decency. The presenter also made a public statement saying he had not intended to cause offence. 11 complainants were not satisfied with the action taken by TVNZ.
And that statement, ordered by the Broadcasting Standards Authority, went on for another 30 seconds, outlining the nature of the breach of standards. And following that formal statement, it was on with the breakfast show, just as usual.
Welcome back. Good to have you with us. Just having a slight bookbind.
And all that then drew a line under an affair which had been in and out of the news since last November. But why was all that really necessary? And who was responsible for saying those bad things in the first place? Well, as even the many hundreds of thousands of people who never watched the TV1 breakfast show will probably know by now, thanks to all the publicity, it was TV1 presenter Paul Henry. And it was back on November the 23rd last year that he said this about Scottish singing sensation Susan Boyle.
She is, in fact, retarded. She
you
is.
You are shocking.
No, it's official.
You are shocking.
No, it's official. She has an intellectual disability.
Oh, my God.
She suffered. What happened was, and this is always bad, she was starved of oxygen and suffered from a mild intellectual disability.
Oh.
And if you look at her carefully, you can make it out. Can't you?
You don't know what you're talking about. And the new idea, Chappelle Corby.
After TVNZ received the first complaints about that back in November last year, they admitted that those remarks breached the standards of good taste and decency as they're set out in the broadcasting codes of practice. TVNZ said that Paul Henry had told its complaints committee that he never intended to offend people with disabilities and quoted him as saying,
"I have a great amount of respect for people who rise to the challenges imposed on them in life."
Though that respect didn't exactly shine through in what he had to say about Susan Boyle that day. As the only apology came from Paul Henry's boss, TVNZ News and Current Affairs Chief Anthony Flannery, it wasn't good enough for People First New Zealand, an outfit led by and campaigning on behalf of people with intellectual disability. They made a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority, and so did 10 other people from Kaitaia to Waikoeti, who also felt strongly enough to pursue the matter with the BSA. And earlier this month, as we now know, the BSA decided that belittling Susan Boyle on the basis of her intellectual disability was a clear breach of the good taste and decency standard. But interestingly, the statement that TVNZ's breakfast show broadcast said nothing about the fact that 3 out of 4 members of the authority also found that Paul Henry's comments breached the broadcasting standard relating to discrimination and denigration. And that's a much more serious breach, because denigration must involve not just mockery, put-downs or mere rudeness, but, according to the authority itself, blackening the reputation of a class of people, coupled with a high level of invective. But just how could a brief bad taste off-the-cuff comment on a morning TV news show really qualify as that? Well, in the written decision that was released recently by the BSA, three authority members said they felt Paul Henry's comments extended beyond Susan Boyle and encompassed all people who suffer from intellectual disabilities, a vulnerable sector of society, they said, whose members cannot easily defend themselves. And Paul Henry's casual assumption that his audience would share his sentiments, they said, reinforced and legitimised particularly repugnant attitudes towards intellectually disabled people. However, one member of the authority disagreed. She reckoned those comments didn't tar an entire section of the community. That meant that the statement the Broadcasting Standards Authority ordered TVNZ to broadcast on Monday referred only to the breach of the good taste and decency requirements, and there was no further penalty for TVNZ. The following day, on Radio New Zealand National's 9 to Noon programme, media commentator Dennis Welsh said that the statement and TVNZ itself should have gone much further.
It did not even refer to Paul Henry by name. It simply said, a presenter, yes.
And Dennis Welsh went on to point out that anyone who wasn't actually watching The Breakfast Show last Monday wouldn't even know that any statement had been made at all.
I looked for a media release, couldn't find one. I went to their website, The Breakfast website. They've got everything there from what's on at the movies to what Pippa's wearing. They've got, for the yesterday morning's program, they've got 10 items you can call up and watch again. None of them include the broadcast statement. So as far as TVNZ said, that was it. They went no further than that. And to my mind, that was really a very sad day for them because they simply didn't have the grace to step up, say to Paul Henry, go on screen, look at the camera, say, I'm sorry for what I said.
Well, several of those who complained to the Broadcasting Standards Authority had also expected a more comprehensive statement from TVNZ last Monday. Among them, People First New Zealand, which had earlier told the BSA that any apology ought to be directed to disabled people and their families, and not just viewers of The Breakfast Show. But in the end, TVNZ has only had to broadcast one statement one time, acknowledging only a lapse of taste and decency, which the broadcaster had already owned up to itself anyway after the first complaints arrived 9 months ago. So I asked the national manager of People First New Zealand, Cindy Johns, if she thought that following the process all the way through since last November had in fact been a waste of time.
People First is still really pleased that we took this complaint all the way, and we're pleased particularly that they did find a breach of two standards. We are disappointed, our members are disappointed with TVNZ's response. People First members would have liked to have seen Paul Henry be made to take responsibility for his actions and to have fronted that statement.
Do you think, though, it's disappointing that the actual complaints process itself doesn't lead to a more comprehensive admission by the broadcaster of the shortcomings of that particular broadcast?
Yeah, I understand, BSA have structure and they work within the legislation assigned to them. So without knowing the detail of that, I can't really comment on that.
Well, whether the outcome of this complaint will do anything to moderate the man, which the chief executive of the BSA recently described as our most complained about individual in the past few years, without a doubt, remains to be seen. But this week I also asked the BSA chief executive, Dominic Sheehan, if he thought that this week's on-air statement from TVNZ was really adequate.
TVNZ did uphold it as a breach of good taste and decency. A lot of the complainants were seeking to have that acknowledged on Breakfast, and that was part of what the order was in this case. But it's, what was people expecting to happen here?
Three out of four people on the authority considered that Paul Henry did denigrate a class of people who are very vulnerable and don't find it easy to fight back or speak out. But for one person reaching that decision, there's really no satisfaction for people who three out of your four members considered were actually denigrated.
Yeah, but that's where I'm coming back to, Colin. It's what were you seeking to achieve? And it's whether the orders and the statement is the sum total of the decision, or whether, in fact, the decision, which is out there on our website for all eternity now, received fantastic publicity all over the place. I mean, everybody was aware of the finding. If that's part of what you were seeking to achieve, then, in fact, those complainants were incredibly successful because they did get an uphold on two standards. Because our decisions, when we put them out, the press do tend to look at them. They especially look at the upholds. And this one, obviously, in particular, did receive pretty wide coverage. We even got international coverage. So, it actually went far and wide.
But wouldn't you agree, though, in the end, that the statement that was broadcast because of one member not agreeing with the other three did actually understate the nature of the original broadcast?
Yeah, sure. And obviously in a situation where there is a minority decision, the board actually still have the power to add that to a statement. It's not that they can't. In this case, they felt that the statement that was broadcast was sufficient to remedy the original breach. But again, you know, there is a decision out there. It does say that, in fact, that Standard 7 was breached.
Right, but if you did happen to miss the statement, then you may not even know. And as Dennis Welsh pointed out, you go to the webpage for that day's breakfast programme on TVNZ's website, there's no mention of any kind of broadcast. And indeed, I went back and looked at the 23rd of November last year, the original Paul Henry broadcast, well, that's there with no acknowledgement that there's any breach of standards about it. So doesn't it sort of behove the broadcaster to actually go beyond just the agreed wording of the statement?
Well, look, you'd have to talk to the broadcasters about that, about where they think their duties and responsibilities lie there. Beyond the orders, they're not required to do anything in terms of what the BSA determines. Remember, there's a layer of self-regulation before anything gets to us. I think it's a very positive system. I know a lot about the systems around the world, and I think we have a system where, in fact, the broadcasters themselves take a great deal of the responsibility for upholding broadcasting standards. It's not necessarily anybody got off scot-free here, if that's the implication.
The BSA's decision at one point said that the authority has afforded significant leeway to Television New Zealand over this broadcaster, Paul Henry, in the past. Does that mean that his record, if we can put it that way, is taken into account when you're considering this complaint or any subsequent one?
Well, in terms of determining whether there's a breach or not, it's always on the facts, always on the broadcast. In fact, the decision itself says, you know, he went too far in this instance. When, you know, we found a breach and we're determining what to do about it, the members will actually look at perhaps if this was a similar breach, if this was a recidivist breach, a person breaching broadcasting standards, that may come into the discussion with orders. But in terms of finding a breach, it's always on the facts, always on the specific case.
That was Dominic Sheehan, the Chief Executive of the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Well, TVNZ's on-air statement acknowledging that breach of good taste and decency has long since dispersed into the ether, but the BSA's consideration of the issue can be found on its website, bsa.govt.nz. And next on Media Watch this week, a longer look at an international news issue which is often under intense scrutiny and also keeps the media complaints bodies here busy from time to time. Conflict in the Middle East. Today we'll hear from two people with opposing views on the media coverage of this, but who both reckon the media doesn't do them justice. But first, Jeremy Rose reports on the sensitivity surrounding the subject, both overseas and here in New Zealand.
One of the few things that pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian groups around the world agree on is that much of the media is biased. The thing they don't agree on is which way that bias leans. There's few, if any, other international topics that come under the same scrutiny, and journalists reporting on the issue know they're entering a political minefield. Last month, CNN sacked its senior Middle East editor, Octavia Nasser, for a tweet saying she was sad to hear of the death of Lebanese cleric Ayatollah Mohammed Hossein Fadlallah. And that he was one of Hezbollah's giants, who she respected a lot. And that sacking followed the resignation of the White House's longest-serving political correspondent, Helen Thomas, in June, after a website posted a recording of her saying that the Jews should get the hell out of Palestine and go back to where they came from. Commentators have variously described those sackings as either evidence that there is a significant anti-Israel or even anti-Semitic element in the mainstream media, or as evidence of the power of a pro-Israel lobby. Well, New Zealand's about as far from the Israel-Palestine conflict as it's possible to get, and with a very small Jewish community and an even smaller Palestinian one, you might think the topic would be less fraught here. But barely a week goes by without a letter to the editor berating a paper's coverage of the Middle East. In Thursday's Dominion Post, for example, there's a letter taking issue with a letter in the previous week's paper, which took issue with an article from the Times of London, which had described Israel as a Jewish state. And on it goes. Just how touchy a subject the Israel-Palestine conflict is nicely summed up in this advice from a Broadcasting Standard Authority decision way back in 1991.
The authority stresses to TVNZ and to all other broadcasters that the use of the words Israel, PLO or the Middle East in news sources should be a sign that their use requires special care. The authority is not suggesting that, because of the sensitivities of some viewers, the items should not be broadcast.
However, it is putting on record that if they are used carelessly by way of accompanying captions or commentary, the authority will have little sympathy for the broadcaster, should it be required to determine further formal complaints about such broadcasts.
The BSA has ruled on 16 complaints broadly concerning the Israel-Palestine conflict over the last decade, with 9 of those coming from groups and individuals that could be broadly described as pro-Israel, and the remainder from either the Wellington Palestine Group or Auckland's Palestine Human Rights Campaign. Of those 16, just 3 were upheld, and all 3 of those dealt with matters of geography. 2 of those were against Television New Zealand, 1 for describing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and 1 for failing to describe East Jerusalem as occupied territory. And a similar complaint against Radio New Zealand was also upheld. Over the same period, the New Zealand Press Council has considered 12 complaints, with just 1 of those being partially upheld. The 12 complaints divided equally between those coming from what might broadly be described as pro-Palestinian or pro-Israel perspectives, with 5 of those coming from the group Kiwis for Balanced Reporting of the Middle East. KBRM will be familiar to many newspaper readers as the organisation that takes out adverts to counter what it describes as the media's often biased and untruthful coverage. The adverts are first submitted to the country's daily newspapers as opinion pieces, but rarely get published. But this week, the Timaru Herald did publish one called Gaza Flotilla, The Missing Truth, by KBRM chairman and founder Dr. Rodney Brooks. The article took a Q&A form with questions and answers, including this one.
Is anyone suffering in Gaza? Yes. Israeli Corporal Gilad Shalit has been held prisoner since June 25, 2006, kidnapped during a raid on Israel when he was 19 years old. Hamas has refused to allow him contact with the International Red Cross or his family, in contravention of international law. When the UN fact-finding mission on the Gaza conflict called for Shalit's release in September 2009, Hamas refused.
Few would question the accuracy of that answer, but some might wonder whether Gilad Shalit is really the only person suffering in Gaza. Media Watch invited Dr. Rodney Brooks, who's currently in the US visiting family, to appear on the program, but after an exchange of a dozen or so emails, we reluctantly told him the conditions he was insisting on amounted to a right of veto. But another group member, Chris Morey, did agree to speak with us. I began by asking why Kiwis for Balanced Reporting was formed.
Well, it was formed in 2006 by people who were concerned about reporting of the then conflict between Israel and Lebanon. The founders felt that the coverage and commentary was one-sided, and they decided to form a group to do something about this.
And you say one-sided, I mean the group's called Kiwis for Balanced Reporting of the Middle East. Which side was it biased towards?
They felt the reporting was basically biased against Israel, Jeremy.
And one of the things which our listeners will be familiar with is the adverts which Kiwis for Balanced Reporting of the Middle East has been taking out fairly regularly in major New Zealand newspapers. Why do you feel the need to take out adverts?
Nearly all adverts are based on articles that our members have written, and they've submitted them to newspapers, offered them for publication, no fee, and generally they get refused. So then we decide that if we decide the message is worth getting out there anyway, we place an ad.
And how's it funded?
They're entirely paid for by the generosity of our members. We don't receive any outside funding at all. We wouldn't want it because it will compromise our independence.
And you mentioned the Lebanon war. Does the group feel that there's been a continuing bias against Israel in the media?
Yes, we do.
Give me some examples of the types of coverage that you think is unbalanced or biased.
Right. There's quite a lot. The reporting on Israel seems peculiarly mixed with sort of various emotive and loaded commentary sort of slipped in amongst the factual stuff in general. There are occasional sort of inaccuracies of fact. I think omissions of fact, just reporting sort of one side of a often very complex question is one of the things we notice. In a survey I did, opinion pieces about Israel are overwhelmingly anti-Israel. The count I had over 8 or 9 months of a couple of papers was 18 to 1, 18 anti to 1 pro.
And which papers were those?
Can I not say that? They're national dailies.
So sorry, why don't you want to say
well,
which...
Well, because we have complaints pending against them, and I don't really feel that's relevant. As far as we can see, the situation is similar in all the big dailies.
The group has taken quite a lot of complaints to the Press Council, some complaints to the Broadcasting Standards Authority.
That's right.
You haven't had much luck. I don't think any of those have been upheld. Why do you think that is?
I wouldn't like to say. I was responsible for one of them. It didn't get upheld, and the reason for that was that I considered the article was factual with inappropriate comment, and the Press Council took the opinion the whole article was comment and therefore appropriate. So that was essentially a difference of opinion. Another one was regarding how the Press Council's rules on letters and selection of letters play out. And, you know, the Press Council ruled that the editor had more discretion than we felt the rules allowed him. So once again, it was a difference of opinion.
You're monitoring the press quite closely, and as your title suggests, you're looking for cases where there's a lack of balance. Does that balance ever go the other direction? Have you identified cases where the balance is in Israel's favour?
I personally haven't ever identified an article where I feel that Israel has been inappropriately praised or Palestinians or anybody else have been inappropriately criticised. I'm talking about, not talking about opinion articles now. There's been one pro-Israel opinion article in the last 8 months I've seen. But in terms of factual articles, I haven't seen bias against the Palestinian cause, but there may have been some, I just haven't seen it.
How difficult is it to distinguish what you might call factual mistakes from opinion and from contested history? I'll use the example of your own website, which has a frequently asked questions section.
Yeah.
And the very first point on that claims that most Palestinians left at the urging of Arab leaders. And I clipped that question and answer and sent it to an Israeli historian who's now at Oxford, Avi Schleim, and asked him whether he thought it was balanced. And, you know, his reply was, it's neither balanced nor fair, and it's propaganda. And isn't that part of the problem, is that this is highly contested?
And it's certainly part of the problem, it's highly contested. And part of the problem, I think, is that we tend to hear a lot more of one side than the other. We tend to hear more of the anti-Israel side than the pro-Israel side. I didn't write this particular FAQ, and if it is wrong, that's obviously quite an authority view saying it's wrong, and I think we need to possibly look at that. But I think the point about this FAQ is that really a question of oversimplification, that what we're trying to counter is the oversimplification that, you know, when the Jews arrived, they expelled the Arabs from Israel, and which is a view that's sometimes put, and that is a gross oversimplification. It would be a gross oversimplification to say that, you know, every Arab left of their own accord, I suspect. You know, the truth is complex, but what we're really saying is don't try and reduce these complex issues to a sort of simple formula about who's right and who's wrong. You know, one side's right, the other side's wrong.
You mentioned the opinion pieces. Most of the coverage in the news sections comes from the wire agencies. How different do you find our coverage than the coverage of that you experienced while you were living and working in Britain?
Well, Jeremy, I think maybe my accent's giving me away. It's a long time since I came to New Zealand, 17 years. I really can't say. What I can say is that the New Zealand papers reprint quite a lot, as well as from services like AP and Reuters. They print quite a lot directly from the British press. And I think the British press varies. Some seems to have more bias against Israel, some seems pretty fair. But I would say the difference in Britain is that one has quite a wide choice of papers to buy, whereas in New Zealand, in most areas outside the main centres, that's not the case.
Just another question about KBRM. How many members and what types of groups do they come from and represent?
Well, we're all individuals. We don't represent groups in that sense. We have about 85 members. They are a complete mixture. We have men and women of all ages, I guess, from sort of probably 20 up to 80. The members are, some of them are of Jewish descent, a lot of them aren't. religion-wise, some of them would certainly describe themselves as Christian. Some are certainly profess Judaism, and some of us profess no religion at all. What really unites us is we want to see Israel given a fair go in the media.
That was Chris Morey from the lobby group Kiwis for Balanced Reporting of the Middle East. And as you heard there, the group is convinced the media regularly publishes articles which are biased against Israel. Australian journalist and author Anthony Lowenstein argues pretty much the opposite of that in his book My Israel Question. He's a controversial figure whose work has appeared in titles such as The Guardian, Washington Post and the Sydney Morning Herald, and back in May he visited New Zealand for the Auckland Writers and Readers Week. When I heard Anthony Lowenstein was going to be in Wellington, I not only arranged to interview him for this program, but organised a meeting in my home for any members of the Wellington Jewish community interested in hearing Anthony Lowenstein's views. And knowledge of that meeting prompted Israel's former honorary consul to New Zealand, David Swartz, to write to me asking that I not go ahead with this item and suggesting that it would, in his words, lead to more problems. David Swartz said he had two main concerns. One was the balance of interviewees, something he knew about through my correspondence with Kiwis for Balanced Reporting regarding their appearance on this program, and the other was that I'd initiated a meeting with Anthony Lowenstein in my home. In my reply to David Swartz, I pointed out that I'd organised the meeting because I felt there would be Wellington Jews who were interested in hearing Anthony Lowenstein speak, but would feel uncomfortable going to his only other Wellington engagement, a fundraising dinner for the Wellington Palestine Group. Now, here's Anthony Lowenstein. I began by asking whether he thought there was either a pro-Israel or pro-Palestinian bias in the media.
I think one of the underlying misconceptions about much of the Western press, both in Australia, New Zealand and America and possibly in Europe, is the sense that we are getting either a biased perspective because one side is given too much airtime over the other. And one of the fundamental, I think, conceits of this idea is the idea that the vast majority of Western journalists in this conflict are based in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, Israeli Jewish cities predominantly. So therefore, it's not surprising that the vast majority of the perspectives that we get are from a generally one perspective. It doesn't mean that therefore other views aren't heard, they are. But when most Western journalists visit, say, the West Bank or Gaza, they go for a day, 2 days, 3 days, maybe a week. But their lives and they are surrounded by the majority of Jewish life. For example, the New York Times bureau chief Ethan Bronner is married to a Jewish person. His child is now in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. The other woman, Isabel Kirshner, is married to a Jew as well. Now, I'm not suggesting that reporters shouldn't be Jewish or marry Jewish people or even have sons in the IDF, although I think that brings up profound issues about objectivity if one has a son in the army, which he may be reporting on the war in the future. But I think the idea, when I was in Israel last year and Palestine as well, the question often comes up, why are there so few journalists based permanently in the West Bank or Gaza? And the answer often is a very lame one, that it's dangerous or it's not easy to do there. The truth of the matter is it wouldn't be difficult to base oneself if a Western news organisation wanted someone to be based there, but they choose not to. And I don't think this is a sign of profound conspiracy. I think it's simply an inherent, I hate to use the word bias, but an inherent support or more sympathy for one side over the other. And the truth is that in most of the Western press, we rarely, if ever, hear Palestinian voices in their own voice rather than filtered through a Western journalist who goes there.
I mean, that's not unique to Israel-Palestine, though, and we don't have people in the Tamil areas of Sri Lanka. We don't have people in Iraq living amongst the
population.
Which
I equally complain about too, yes.
But when you look at the actual coverage, is there other forms of bias? Because one of the things that supporters of Israel would claim is that there's a bias towards publishing crimes of Israel, which would simply go unnoticed in other countries. So, you know, for example, crimes committed by Syria or other countries in the region, Iran, don't get the same amount of attention, do they, than crimes committed by the IDF?
I would suggest, in fact, that most of the crimes of the IDF go unbelievably unreported. And I think the reason for that is the occupation, which continues and has been going for over 40 years, is a crime every day. I mean, one only has to look at and spend any time in the West Bank or read human rights reports from either the Western human rights groups or even Israeli or Arab ones. And these sort of abuses are happening every day. One doesn't read the systematic daily humiliation at checkpoints. You read stories about it, of course you do. You read about if a Palestinian might be shot, or you might read, but you don't read, for example, the incredible increase in the last 6 months of arrests of non-violent protest leaders in the West Bank who are protesting against the wall that's being built through the occupied territories. I think one of the underlying problems also is a sense that somehow by reporting Israeli alleged crimes, IDF or others, you're being biased. Well, this is like saying that during apartheid South Africa, one shouldn't report on crimes committed by the state because, gee, the ANC may have been bombing people as well. One needs to obviously be equally condemnatory of military actions against all sides. One of the underlying, I think, problems also remains that we have a problem in the West, and this has exacerbated since 9/11, of what exactly is violence and what is terrorism. And in the media reporting, particularly since 9/11, any violent act directed at a Western state is seemingly defined as terrorism. The truth of the matter is that under international law there is legitimate right to resistance. Doesn't mean that one has the right to blow up buses in Tel Aviv. That is clearly a crime and I condemn that unquestionably. But resisting occupation, attacking military targets is not terrorism in any country. You're attacking soldiers who have lives and families, and obviously I'm not wishing soldiers to be killed. I don't mean that. What I say is that in Israel, the vast majority of violence that's directed from Palestinians against Israelis, and there's not much of that anymore these days, is not directed at civilians. Attacking soldiers who are illegally occupying land is not terrorism. It's not terrorism.
The rockets coming out of Gaza
is terrorism. Undoubtedly terrorism from Hamas, from any other group in Gaza. Terrorism should be condemned and is condemned by many people, including me. But this is very different to the vast majority of terrorism that occurs on a daily basis that is inherent within the occupation. I think those kind of nuances or those understandings of what occupation is, in fact, is not talked about very much. That's, I think, partly because most or very few Western journalists live within that world to see it every day.
I'll come back to that point, though, of the amount of focus that we do have on Israel in comparison with other countries, so Sri Lanka and the Tamils, or, you know, even within the region, like I said, it's not uncommon for people to be persecuted, arrested, right across that region.
True.
And I think Israelis say you've got one standard for us and another for them.
This argument's often made, and I certainly, speaking for myself, my own work, have spent a lot of time in the rest of the Arab world, away from Israel, Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and written extensively about the profound human rights abuses that go on. We shouldn't forget, of course, that many of those states are also backed and funded by the US, Iran and Syria aside. The fundamental difference, though, is that Syria is not a democracy. It doesn't claim to be a democracy. Saudi Arabia couldn't, and Egypt and the others don't either. Israel claims to be a democracy, and more importantly, Israel receives funding and support from us, from Australia, from America. So therefore, we have a responsibility and a right, in fact, to question actions that are essentially supported and funded by us. There undoubtedly at times probably is bias, and if you ask me, as you just have, is there too much discussion about Israel as opposed to Iran or Syria? I would probably agree, and that's one of the reasons in my last book I talked about those other questions about how these nations both abuse human rights and how little we actually know about it, which is partly, I think, the fault of not giving more voice to, for example, I say bloggers in these particular countries, which are giving many of us in the West a sense of what people on the ground are thinking rather than simply Western journalists who go to Tehran for 2 days and then leave.
I think if you talk to any journalist, you'll find that if they've covered this topic, they get more response than to virtually anything else. And that's from both sides, from Palestine supporters as well. In your study of the topic, did you find that journalists were being influenced by the pressure from either side?
I think it very much depends, of course, which media outlet they work for. Certainly there's no doubt that in many, many examples that I spoke to journalists and editors, what I think often happens is a degree of self-censorship. Not always, of course. I would actually totally disagree with the premise of your question. In fact, the majority of my experience is that if there's an article that appears, say, in a newspaper today, that's seen as very pro-Israel, so to speak, you probably will have maybe one or two letters of complaint opposing it to the editor. If, on the other hand, you have a letter or an article fundamentally critical of Israel, you're going to be bombarded. And that Jews have every right to complain about an article. Of course they do. But I think what often happens to many journalists, and I hear this time and time and time again, many say, if we go to this subject, if we provide a perspective which is not just simply reporting the news, so to speak, we are going to be bombarded with letters, with complaints. There's a complaint process, in particularly in public broadcasting, like here, I presume, at the ABC in Australia, that ties people up for months. And the reason why I use that as an example is that many journalists I know at the ABC in Australia, or indeed in the States, will say that often they will not put on certain people, certain positions, not extremists, but people who might be critical, particularly of Israel, because if they do, they'll be caught up in red tape indefinitely. And the reason I think that is a problem is that the so-called organised Muslim community, Palestinian community, call it what you want, there is not the same level of lobbying. Now, of course, the Jewish community would say we're being criticised for being effective. And as I said, I've never said, and nor do I say now, that Jews haven't got the right to lobby. Of course they do. But the point is that they often, we see time and time again, elements in the Jewish community try and actively stop certain perspectives being heard. In my book, My Israel Question, I talk about that extensively, of how many examples in the US and elsewhere, certain perspectives, criticisms of the occupation, criticisms of Israeli government policy, are deemed inappropriate and not heard. And I think one of the underlying profound moral failings of much of the Western press is to allow a situation in the occupation to be normalised. I think there's no doubt that in many, many areas, these sort of questions have been allowed to pass for far too long.
That was Anthony Lowenstein, the author of the book My Israel Question, speaking there to Media Watch's Jeremy Rose. Well, next week, Jeremy will have more on the question of balance and the coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict when he talks to a journalist here who's researched the picture that New Zealand's newspapers offer their readers. For now, though, that's all from the Media Watch team for this weekend, but we'll be back again with plenty more on the media next week, so join us again at the same time next Sunday here on Radio New Zealand National.